Okay, you guys, here we go. She Runs Ultras, episode number 124. And this is the first official episode of the new year. Welcome to 2023. So many epic things are going to happen in this upcoming year. The first of which is this conversation, this podcast episode that I had with Sarah Brandt. Actually back in November. So this one, I've been sitting on this one for a while, you guys, and I'm really excited that you're going to get to hear it because, as per usual, Sarah has some really amazing thoughts and insights about her first 100-mile experience. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Sarah Brandt. What I mentioned earlier was that I was going to tell people to go back and listen to your first episode so they can get the whole story of how you started out getting interested in ultras and how we came to work together and all that jazz. And so, because that's an amazing episode that we recorded twice and we want people to hear that. But I really want to talk today about what happened after all that. This is sort of like behind the scenes, like, you know, the story that you haven't heard yet, because you not only did your first ultra this year, your first 50K, you did your first 50 miles, and then you did something else amazing. And I'm thinking, like, I guess, spoiler alert, like you ran your first 100 miler, like they're going to figure it out anyway. So we might as well just tell them up front. So I don't know, where do you want to start? Like, where do you want to start talking about after finishing Notchview and coming in second in your age group, right? Or winning your age group, second in your age group.
Winning my age group.
How could I possibly forget that?
I think that the run-up between Notchview and Ghost Train was really important and definitely shaped how everything played out at Ghost Train. So I think that's kind of important to talk about. And if you haven't listened to the episode, here's the elevator speech version. I intended on running a 50K in June of this past year, 2022, and got COVID, couldn't do it. So ended up running a race about 3 weeks later in July. That was the Notchview. I did 50 miles. It was a great day. Listen to the episode. It was really fun. and that, you know, 3 weeks it's not that great amount of time, but that cut into the amount of time between the 50 miler and then Ghost Train, which was the second weekend of October, October 15th and 16th. So I ended up feeling not super great about the training that happened between Notchview and Ghost Train, not because it didn't happen or it didn't, you know, get checked off the list. I just felt like, you know, there was the high of Notchview and it was this great experience and all this reflection about it and talking to you and recording the podcast twice. And it's like mentally I was still there, and then shifting to prepare for Ghost Train was, I think, more challenging than I anticipated. And, you know, the time of year is busy. I'm in education, but I work through the summer, and then we had a family vacation, and it's just a lot was going on, and it just felt that the rest of my life was really busy and I was still getting the training done, but it just didn't feel super locked in. Like, it felt a little bit loosey-goosey mentally. Like, I was I was getting the things done, but it just didn't feel quite as solid as I had felt going into Notchview. And I think that, I guess in some ways that was good because it prepared me to, you know, even if you don't have the best kind of session, you know, number of sessions over a couple of weeks or whatever, you know, you're still doing the work. But I definitely felt like off. I just didn't feel locked in and, you know, ready to go necessarily. And then at the end of the summer, it was late August, I was out on a long run, probably, I think it was maybe 22 or 24 miles or something. And I just ended up with this pain in my hip. And long story short, it was essentially an overuse injury. And over the next few weeks, I tried every manner to manage it. And I had the draft email in my email of pulling out a Ghost Train, because I was like, I just don't know that this can happen. And
that's news to me. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. I was pretty sure, like 10 days out, that it wasn't going to happen. And then I kind of decided, well, I ended up getting trigger point injections, which was miraculous. And I'm sure you could speak to medical professionals about why they can be helpful in some situations. And that got me, I wouldn't necessarily say shipshape, like I wasn't 100%, mm-hmm. but I was good enough that I was like, well, I'm gonna show up. I'm gonna do what I can do. And if I get to the point during the race that I feel like it's starting to nag and I can feel that it's trending towards injury rather than just discomfort or I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then I can stop. You know, I can go out there. I can learn what I'm going to learn at this race. But it definitely didn't have this, like, you know, glorious firework lead up. Like, I felt like the Notchu lead up was really solid. And I just felt really good and locked in. And it was mm-hmm. super duper not that way leading into Ghost Train, which mm-hmm. Was unfortunate, but it is what it is sometimes.
Yeah, that can kind of be a little unnerving too. And I think you're sort of highlighting this idea of, you know, if you have a really solid training block like you did heading into Notchview, I actually just made a little note while you were talking about that, like switching gears, this idea that you dropped, like switching gears from, okay, I had this really great race at Notchview. I exceeded my expectations. That was great. You're riding the high. Now I have to switch gears and ramp up or transition from that into the next thing. And that can sometimes be difficult, especially if it is a thing, a race or a distance that you have no experience at. And so you have nothing to gauge it against. So you don't know if the training is going well or not. I mean, on a basic level, you obviously know if it's going well or not because you're either showing up or you're not, and you're either completing the runs or you're having injury, like excessive amounts of injuries or whatever, right? Sort of a very loose determination on good or not. But you know how things went for leading up to Notchview. And so having that as your sort of litmus test, like comparing everything to that, if you were trying to do an apples to apples comparison, it's not going to happen. And so I'm not surprised, but I'm pleasantly surprised that you didn't hit that send on that email because, and I think, you know, you and I traded some messages back and forth where we were like, okay, like try this, try that, try this, try that. You know, you literally threw everything but the kitchen sink at it. And I was happy to see that you went and at least, you know, like you just mentioned, like gave it the old college try, so to speak, because you can always stop. Like that's the thing, you know, you can always stop, and there's nothing wrong with taking that approach, because I think how do I want to say this? Sometimes what happens is people get caught up in that cycle where they feel so unsure about the training because they've had a previous experience where things have gone so well that they never pull the trigger on actually completing the next big race because they're constantly comparing it to what happened previously and thinking, if it doesn't happen like that, like it did before, then I'm just not ready. And what you're demonstrating is, okay, I can still go through this whole process and I can still feel quote unquote not ready. Things aren't quite dialed in. I'm just not feeling it 100%. Still show up, still start, still try, and then sort of roll the dice and see what happens. And I think a lot of times if people took that approach more regularly, they would be shocked and surprised at what they were capable of doing.
I think too that I kind of came at it with like, okay, so if the running or the walking or the movement isn't the way I envisioned it, I can practice my nutrition. I can practice my gear. I can practice moving. I can practice being out at night. I can practice, you know, working with my crew and my pacers. There were so many other things that weren't necessarily reliant on my hip that I decided, well, all these people are lined up. The stuff is packed. Like, let's just do it. And if certain things don't go the way I envisioned, you know, it's never going to go perfectly according to plan. So at least I could mm-hmm. get some good practice in with the other things. And then the hip ended up totally fine. So some of the other things less fine, but the hip was totally fine. So amazingly, I was able to keep moving through that period of time. So,
and the funny part about that is too, that it's been my experience that I can't quantify it. I can't say like, oh, 75% of the time this is going to happen. But it has been my experience that in the lead up to a longer or bigger race, especially if it's your second one of the year, that there is more stuff that goes wrong leading up to it, meaning like your body starts to mount a little mini revolt and is like, you know, it's trying to throw up red flags. And some of them are legitimate red flags, right? Like yeah. This hip thing was very legitimate. But when you first wrote to me, I was like, okay, this could be, you know, one of two things. This could be sort of the little red flag, like, you know, just don't do it. Like, yeah, right. Just don't do it. Or it could be your big red flag and yeah. Only time will really tell. And oftentimes if it's the little red flag, it sort of miraculously resolves itself beforehand, like before the race or even the day of the race, right? But sometimes you do have to seek external intervention like you did where you were throwing everything at it. And that's going to solve the issue too. So just I throw that out there because some people also take that as a sign like, oh, my hip is I can't do it because now my hip is crazy. It's like, okay, take a beat. What's really going on? You know, can you sort of dial back for a day or two? Can you like, do you have somebody that you could go see? Like, what's your pain level? Like, don't immediately hit send on that email to like pull yourself from the race until you've sort of done your due diligence, which you obviously did.
The two other things I think that I learned in this lead up were that I didn't give myself enough time between the two races. And part of that was just because it was delayed. And I think it ended up being like 14 weeks or something between, I'd have to look back. It was about 14 mm-hmm. weeks between the two, which I think I underestimated the recovery. You know, it's 14 weeks, but that's including the recovery from Notchview. And then, mm-hmm. and then I wanted to, you know, have some semblance of another build, which, and then a taper. So I just ended up, it felt too crunched. And I think that looking ahead, I'm going to be really mindful that like we're not going into July, at least not with the distance of 50 again. I don't think that mm-hmm. worked really well for me. And the other thing was that I went a little too far in the like run every run exactly similar conditions to what the race will be, because I think that this hip thing was an overuse injury, that I ran lots and lots of rail trail and lots of flats, because that's essentially what Ghost Train is. Mm-hmm. And I did not include enough variety of terrain or of elevation or mm-hmm. ascending and descending. And that ended up just doing more damage than good. So I mm-hmm. had a lot of hours on the rail trail, a real, real lot of hours on the rail trail. But I would have been better off to include more variety. So mm-hmm. lesson learned big time on that one.
And that's sort of a tricky balance too, right? Because Ghost Train is very, very, very flat, with the exception of the one hill that's maybe, I'd have to go back and look at, you know, Garmin data, maybe a couple hundred feet, like 200 feet, if that, right?
Since Ghost Train, I re-listened to your report on Ghost Train, and I think at one point, I listened to it like a couple days or a week later, and I think you said something about it being a bump, and I was like, I take issue with that characterization of that hill, because it just got bigger and bigger every time yeah. you do it. It's like, it felt a lot more than a bump to me.
Yeah, no disagreement from me there. But if you were looking at it a race course profile, you'd be like, yeah. no problem. And honestly, the first couple of times you do it, it is really no problem. But yeah, I mean, when you're deep into those nighttime and like early morning laps yeah. on the second day, like, yeah, that thing is huge. But there is there's a tricky part to this race, because you would think, and this is sort of, so it's an interesting juxtaposition, because I went into this race having the opposite sort of approach. I don't know, maybe, well, definitely first time, because I hadn't done it before, where I was like, oh, flat, no problem. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really train flats going into yeah. it before, because I was coming off of Ragged. I was coming off of BFC. I was coming off of stuff with a lot of elevation change, yeah. a lot of difficult, sometimes hand over fist, like difficult stuff. So I was like, oh, flats, no problem. Yeah. Well, come tell me that after 60 miles of running on basically dead flat rail trail, that's a whole other game. So there is a certain sweet spot, and that's going to probably be different for everybody, right? But I do think that there's something in between what you and I are talking about, like training no flats and training all the flats. Yep. Like there's some point in the middle there. I don't know exactly what it is. It's going to be specific to each person, but you know, this is the beauty of doing the race multiple times. You get to learn from it, and then you get to extrapolate that if you choose to do another race that has a very sort of similar course profile.
I think similar to, oh, flats, no problem, is, oh, walking, no problem. Mm-hmm. That, you know, well, I can walk. That shouldn't be a problem. And I knew that there would be a very, very healthy amount of walking in this race for me. And I definitely didn't train enough walking, for sure. And you talk about walking as being such a key piece of ultra training. And I didn't do enough of it. And I need to give it more weight in the future, for sure, because those muscles are different. And we'll get there eventually, but like the pace I was holding for the last 10 miles was like almost hysterical. It was like, just to be able to walk those last 10 miles, I was like, how can this be so hard? I'm going so slow. But
I should have gone back and looked at my pace for the last 10 miles, because I guarantee you mine is also like probably either right up there or right down there, like however you want to look at it, right there with yours. Because by the time you hit 90 miles, you know, the thing about this race is you have to do the out and back full loops, and then you go out on this sort of half of a half loop where you go out 5 miles to a random turnaround point. And I always take a proof of life picture, like you guys, take this proof of life picture. Like if I'm like, I don't want anyone questioning me. Like here's the timestamp. Like here's, you know, it's on my phone. Like it timestamped the image on the phone. This is it. So you just walk, you go to this random turnaround spot, and then you turn around and walk back. And that my pace on those last 10 miles was pretty slow. Yeah. So I can appreciate that.
Lesson learned for me, for sure. Incorporate more walking. I think it would have made a big difference if I had been more efficient.
So then sort of walk us through the day, like, cause I think this is the part that people get pretty interested about, like what's the setup, what's the start time, how did you, you know, go out, what were some of the highs, some of the lows, if you can sort of like just paint the picture.
So the race is in Southern New Hampshire, and it's about an hour and 15 minutes or so from where I live. So we could have gone out the night before to camp, but decided to go out that morning, just wake up early. It's not, it's a 9 a.m. start, so later than a lot of other races. So there was really no major push to like wake up at 2 a.m. or anything. We're able to get up, you know, early, but not unreasonable. The car was totally packed with, it looked like we were going on a 6-month expedition. Yeah. It's utterly absurd. And I said, like, is this normal? But then when you get there and you look around, you're like, yeah, I guess it is. I guess everybody has all this stuff. It's my husband Rick and I went up together, and he had done this race before two times, and I had crewed for him, so we were familiar with where to park and where, you know, all of these things, which are the little details that you sometimes can get caught up on. So we also kind of knew where people set up their tents and their aid stations. So we were able to get right in there and grab a spot. And we had it's not really a pop tent, but it's a shelter. And we had a folding table and a tarp for the bottom. And then I had gone through all my gear, and I mean, it was labeled. There were bags with, you know, this category and that category for my food and my clothing and all of this. So it was pretty well organized ahead of time. And Rick and I both set everything up, chairs, all that. And then we're in the middle of setting up, and everybody's pretty close to each other in terms of tents. They're kind of right next to each other. And we had set up next to this pretty large tent, and we're going along, and all of a sudden I kind of hear these people talking, and I realized that it was Frank, your pacer and your friend and pacer from Tahoe, and totally unintentional. I had never seen him or met him, but I heard that voice, and you had just released your episode about that you interviewed him about pacing you at Tahoe. So I had listened to that episode and recognized his voice. So it was kind of a fun coincidence that we ended up right next to Frank and his wife. Everybody's setting up. There's a lot of energy. You know, they got the music going. Everybody grabs their number. And it didn't, I was worried that the morning would feel like it would take forever to you know, you get all your stuff and then you just have to sit and wait. But there's plenty to do, you know, and so many interesting people and things, you know, the time went fast without feeling too fast. It was just right. It was just right. So I had kept an eye on the weather report, so I knew which gear I wanted to wear, you know, to start out, and had that all on and numbers on, and a pack goes on and off we go. So we had,
and it was like pretty warm. It was warmer than I thought it was going to be for that weekend. So that was,
yeah,
the nice for you guys.
Previous year was hot. It was really, really warm the previous year, which you ran that one, right? So yep. We were pleasantly warm without being the, you know, real heat that you experienced. I was in a t-shirt and you know, short leggings for much of the day, and I was totally comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we had a number of other folks who were set up near us that we knew, so that was kind of fun. They were all running, I think they both did 30, so they were mm-hmm. they were long gone. But it's a pretty low-key race in terms of, you know, like ready, set, go. It's not,
yeah.
And everybody kind of just starts going. It's very low. There's no, you know, starting gun or anything like that. Just here we go, off you go. And,
yep.
And then it's like, you're just surrounded by people. And I knew some other folks that were running, but we hadn't really coordinated too much for the morning. So I just kind of was on my own for the beginning part, which was fine. I just kind of tried to settle in, and I had never run on this particular rail trail. So that was totally new for me. So get to see the course, which I came to know rather well. Funny though, you also mentioned in your previous Ghost Train episode that, you know, you end up with essentially six and two thirds laps. You do this lap, yep. This loop 6 2/3 times. And you had said, like, I don't really remember like when the tunnels come and when the road crossing is and all this. And I was kind of like, how do you not know where all the things happen? Like, don't you just get to know them? And then like 80 miles in, I'm like, did we go through a tunnel? Where is the, to this day, I could not tell you at which tunnel comes first. It's too funny. I don't know what it is about it. And maybe it's because it's so flat that everything just sort of blends together. But not only could I not tell you now, but like during that moment, did we go through a tunnel yet? I literally cannot remember.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is such a thing too. It's like, it's funny because like, I think we were talking about this with Frank. He fully knows the course like the back of his hand, which is great. I, like I said before, chose to mentally check out,
yeah,
because it's so hard to get lost on that,
yep,
course. I mean, you would really have to try. You'd really have to be so tired with no pacer. I mean, you'd really have to, yeah, try. So I made it a mental point to check out and just run because it was one less thing,
yep,
that I had to do. And if I could devote that energy to eating or drinking or taking care of my body or doing whatever else. And so I'm I'm pleasantly surprised, but also not shocked that, yeah, that was your experience as well.
Just when you had mentioned it, I was like, wow, that's an interesting thing that is not me at all. And then totally was me. Exactly. I don't, yep, have any idea where we are. Thank goodness for pacers with more mental capacity to tell us what's happening.
Yeah.
But so I ran, you hit the first aid station around 4 miles in. And then I do know that after the first aid station is when there's the hill, quote unquote, the bump.
Yep.
And I was on my way up and over that when I ran into my friend Nicole, who I ended up doing almost the entire race with. She is a Ghost Train expert. I think this was her fourth 100 miler. And then she's done a few other Ghost Trains with less distance as well. So she just keeps coming back for more. So she is an expert. So I was really glad to hook up with her because we have run together a few times and we just have a similar pace and everything. So it was great to hook up with her. And then we were together pretty much until the last maybe lap or two, in which case she headed out ahead of me. But that was really fun to just have a buddy for the rest of the time.
Yeah, because you can also, you know, like you were talking about before, there, you, when you start, everybody starts together, with the exception of the people at this race that are doing the just the 15 miler, because they do it on a separate day. So anybody who's running 30, 45, 60, 75, 90, like anybody who wants to run any multiple of 15, they're all starting at once. So I want to say maybe there were like 400 people. I don't know if that sounds right to you. I feel like maybe that was what the, like somewhere in that ballpark. So, you know, it's a lot of people, but then as the day progresses, the numbers start to drop off because either people have achieved their goal or they decide I'm done or whatever. So by the time you get to, you know, by the time you probably got to maybe like 45 miles, the numbers were maybe, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe half of what you started. So it's cool that you can find people, you know, you'll sort of, my experience has been, you'll see people at the beginning of the day and then you just stop seeing some of those faces, but then you recognize the faces that you know are sort of going for the full distance. And those are the people that you sort of, you know, because you're actually doing out and back laps. So you're passing these people, you know, fairly consistently, unless they lap you, which is also a thing.
Yep, absolutely.
But you're making friends, you know, like doing the out and back laps and getting to know who's on the course with you at any given time.
I think one of the things, what the biggest takeaway from this whole race was, that I really need to dial in the nutrition. I had lots and lots of options. And I think this is something that's really hard to know ahead of time, what's going to work for you and what's not. And I had this anticipation that when things go south, you're going to, I would have nausea, or I, you know, you know, heartburn is an issue for me sometimes. So I was kind of anticipating all of these things that might happen with how I was feeling. What I did not anticipate was that I would have absolutely no interest in food whatsoever. I did not think about that as a symptom. And I'll get into my amazing pacers and how they helped. But after the race, it was literally like a week later, and I cleaned out my vest, there was all this food like shoved in of my pockets, because I kept like taking food and I'd take like one teeny tiny nibble of it, and then I'd like shove a half eaten Swedish fish into my pocket, or like a half of a Fig Newton, or there's like a peanut butter sandwich.
All gross. Smashed up.
But I just like could not, the thought of like chewing and swallowing the food, I was like, I can't even eat half of a Fig Newton. I just couldn't do it. So I think I have to, so many things I have to do better with nutrition. That's a long list of things to improve for sure.
So two quick thoughts before they leave my head. First, after I finish the second thought, I want you to sort of tell us the cadence, like how did you start out with your nutrition, right? But second, I just want to, almost maybe like half of the most recent round of Run Your First 50Kers that like just finished the October group stated that this eating while running was a real sticking point for them. And so I just want to sort of like highlight this, because if you don't practice it, and now I know Sarah has practiced this a lot, so this is sort of like see it happens at every level type of a thing, but you have to practice at the beginning. And so I'm specifically sort of talking to those five or six women that were just in the last group, where I'm like, okay, see, you have to practice this. And even at some points you might figure out that like it's still tough. So that there's no, like, just keep going, just keep practicing, because you do need to keep eating. I was just reading a comment from someone else, that said the very same thing, that they did not anticipate the fact that they would be wholly uninterested in food. And that, I think, is where, you know, when I was sort of doing a little bit of a debrief with Frank on this very same race, that's, I think, where he sort of had a little bit of a curveball thrown at him, like, you know, just not interested in food, underfueled, didn't want to eat, found it difficult to eat. So it's one of the sort of sleeper factors in running long distances. Like, you can't come at it. And this was something that I did poorly on my first ghost train. And part of the reason why I had to stop was just like, I treated it like it was a 50 mile race, and it's not.
Yeah. I think
so. Tell us like what your strategy was.
I had a number of foods that I had eaten on all of my runs, and I knew that settled well. And it was things like Fig Newtons and Stroopwafels and pretzels and sometimes chips. I kind of like could take it or leave it with the chips. I've done ginger ale, but not a ton. And certainly Tailwind. I had no problem with Tailwind. So peanut butter sandwiches, some as well, and pierogies. I like pre-made a bunch of pierogies and had those ready to go.
And just explain what those are for people, because I think there are some people listening that might not know what those are.
They're like ravioli, but instead of cheese inside, they have mashed potatoes. And they're so good.
They are so good.
I just bought frozen ones and cooked them the night before and had it ready to go. And these are all things that I have eaten on long runs and had no problem. And I've never experienced not being hungry. Mm-hmm. So I think that the problem was that when I lost interest in all of the things that have worked well for me, I didn't have a plan B. It was mm-hmm. like, well, now you're just going to trick your pacer and pretend you're eating food, but actually squirrel it away into your vest. And I think next time she's going to have to like check to, you know, make sure I actually eat the food. But I think I'd like to experiment a little bit more with more liquid or like pureed type food, which the thought of is revolting sort of, but I think that it would work better for me. And mm-hmm. I did do those squeezy applesauce pouches. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go too heavy on apples just because of the acidity, but mm-hmm. I think that that type of thing, you know, on a general day, I wouldn't really care for that. But I think in the context of the long run, I could have, like, once it's in, and then you're going to get the benefit from it. So I think I'd like to explore that certainly. And I had all this stuff in my vest so I could have it when I wanted it, but it sort of seems like it. You end up just doing it at the aid stations. And I think I could have been better about, you know, setting a timer or having something that would, you know, alert me to the fact you got to take something.
So you only ate really like at the aid stations? Is that what you're saying? And not in between?
No, I did eat in between, but it wasn't strategic. It wasn't like, oh, 20 minutes is gone. It's time to get X amount of carbs or protein or whatever. It was just like, ooh, a wheat thin. Like it wasn't strategic. It was just like, I'm bored, I'll eat a whatever. So like having an actual plan on when to take in the nutrition is for sure something I need to do better. I told you I was going to tell you a funny story about yes. nutrition. And Nicole, who I ran Ghost Train with, is a dietitian. So we spent a good amount of time talking about food. She is not a dietitian in any sports sense. She works with children who have challenges with eating and feeding. So she doesn't do like sports-based nutrition, but she and I had both just listened to your episode with Julie Shoeb about fueling ultras. And so we were talking about the 60 grams of carbs per hour and how that was so much more than either mm-hmm. of us have ever done. And we really need to find a way to do it. And Nicole said, I figured out that a Pringle is a gram of carbs. So you just need to eat 60 Pringles an hour. So if you just set your watch to beep every minute, boop, eat a Pringle. So 60 Pringles per hour and you're going to get all the carbs that you need to fuel your ultra. I'm just kidding. Don't actually do that. But by the math.
No, I like that idea. But I think the bigger problem is how do you keep 60 Pringles from turning into Pringle dust?
I guess
every
you need like a spoon that is equivalent to one Pringle. So now every time I'm food shopping and I see like the display of the 400 flavors of Pringles they make, I take a picture and send
it. Oh my God.
Pringle time.
That is amazing. That's the kind of math that I think is just like so classic ultra runners. They're just like, okay, how do we problem solve? What's the thing that we have the closest context for? And okay, now we'll just extrapolate yep. that out. So
and it was also one of those things that, you know, you're together for a really long time and things that maybe wouldn't be that funny in another context are like the most hysterical thing. So we
for sure.
just were rolling over laughing so hard about the whole Pringle situation, which in retelling it, people are like, oh, that's pretty weird. Yeah,
no, I'm fully with you. No, I'm fully with yeah. you. I bet that a lot of people listening to this will all also be fully with you on this. Like just the, you know, just the whole understanding of how much you need to eat and how it's not necessarily the easiest thing to do while you're moving, right? That was one of the things that with the last Run Your First 50K group, we talked about a lot, like practice while you're walking first, take a snack with you, even if you don't quote unquote need a snack for this walk, like you're not actually fueling this walk, what you're actually doing is training your stomach to just accept food while you're moving. And it starts with walking, and then it starts with, then you progress to a walk run and you're doing it then. Then it's when you're running. And even on shorter runs, when you don't even really need to quote unquote fuel that run, it's like, we're training the stomach. We're training the stomach all the time. And that's a big component that you've highlighted even right now.
Yeah. I think I did do pretty well with hydration. Mm-hmm. I felt a good balance of water and tailwind. I did have some broth here and there, and then Coke, I think once or twice, ginger ale, maybe once or twice, but just the tailwind and the water. I had a flask on the front in my vest. I didn't end up using a bladder just because I was going through the aid station so often. I just carried the flasks, and I felt like toward the end of the race, I was stopping at every aid station to pee. So I knew I was hydrated enough, but I felt good about being able to take in fluids. That was never a problem.
Yeah. And as long as you were having some tailwind too, like you're getting a little, you know, you're getting some calories there as well. So you're not, that was always sort of like my justification for either not eating or delaying eating. I'm like, oh, I'm just drinking tailwind, which I'm not suggesting is a good way to go about it. But, you know, again, it's sort of like mid-race justification. It's the things that you tell yourself, and then you realize, you know, okay, you sort of slap yourself on the wrist and get back to the plan, or you realize that you're digging yourself a big hole, and then that's really the impetus to get back to the plan.
Yeah. I never felt like I crashed because of the poor nutrition choices. I just kind of slowly got flatter and flatter. I never had a real serious, energy slump or anything in terms of feeling, you know, dizzy or anything like that. But I just know that it could have been better for sure.
Yeah. So you start out 9 a.m., you do the first loop, you know, your first 15 miles, everything good. How's the hip?
That was the thing that was hard for me, was to get my mind off of it. Cause it's like, if it's going to go south, and it would happen very, very quickly, and I could tell the difference between like, oh, I just need to shake things out, and this is going to be a problem now. I could tell the feeling because I'd been dealing with it for a while. So I had to really work to get my mind off of that, like with every stride thinking, is it now? Is it now? Is it now? So I kind of decided to, I just kind of had to let it go. And having that hill, you know, partway through was helpful to kind of change up the way that you're moving, you know, because you go up the hill and then on the other side you go down the hill. And so I met up with Nicole during that first loop, and then we did the next few, just the two of us, and, you know, with other people around, but we didn't have pacers through. I have this written down because I have to, I wrote it all down so I could remember.
Time is fluid.
Oh, it really is. It really is. So at the end of 45 miles, so it was the third lap was when we went out on that lap, we took our headlamps and lights and things because we knew it was going to get dark during that lap, and it did. And we came in on that one. That was when I saw you, because we came in and it was funny. I knew that you were probably going to be there, and my husband had come up to where you come in on the trail, and he was kind of walking us into the aid station. He's like, oh, you're gonna be excited, somebody's here. I had absolutely no idea. I in my head, who's here, like what are you talking about?
Mystery guest.
It was me, which was so nice. And it was fun because we were right next to Frank, so you were able to cheer for Frank, and we were able to see you, which was so fun. And then that was when my husband Rick came out with us for our first lap with a pacer, which was like the value of having Rick and then my other pacer Ruth, who I'll talk about, was just, it's so valuable. Without question, things would not have, I would not have finished without them. Mm-hmm. So I cannot overstate how awesome it was to have them. And I will say Rick did such a phenomenal job crewing that we had friends who were like, can he crew for me? He did such a good job. He was on top of everything. Mm-hmm. He remembered things that I certainly wasn't on top of, and making sure the food was right there and the gear was right there, and take this and grab this. And, you know, he's a very, very fast runner. So I was hoping he wouldn't be bored out of his mind slogging along with us, but he was right there and, you know, had a good sense of when to like gently encourage, like, hey, should we do some run intervals, and when it was mm-hmm. not the right time.
And I can attest to Rick's crewing skills, because I was there and watched him, and he was like, when you guys were sort of going through the motions, like you were sitting down in the chair, you know, changing some clothes and doing some other things, like he was like, somebody asked, I don't know if it was you or Ruth, asked for something, and he knew right away where it was and how much was left, and like yeah, he had the yeah. whole thing like all dialed in. It was
he
so
really did.
It was so good to see. And he also had the added benefit of having done that race before too, so yeah. you know, you can tell what you need when a little bit and anticipate and just understand, you know, the dynamics of the race. Whereas if you're going in yeah. there blind, you're a little behind the eight ball because you yeah. don't quite have a sense for what's going on. But no, he was totally on it.
And neither of us have done a race through the night before. Mm. So that was new in terms of how does he manage his sleep, and how do he and Ruth manage who's going out when and who's sleeping when, but I just let them take care of that.
Did either of them go sleep in the van?
I don't think they slept. Oh, that van behind us. Yeah. There was a lady in a camper van behind us who like offered if anybody wanted to go sleep in the van while she was out on the course. Like that might be a little weird if she comes back.
That's what I was thinking.
And there's like a strange man in her van, but she was really, she's like, we have Wi-Fi. I was like, oh, wow. That's heat and Wi-Fi. What else do you need?
I mean, but, that's a crew, a crew and pacer's dream right there, is to have an enclosed van with heat and Wi-Fi
and a place to charge your phone. What yes. else do you need?
Yep.
Yeah. So Rick was our pacer for that first lap. And then from then on out, every lap, Rick alternated with my friend Ruth, who is a friend since middle school. So we have known each other through thick and thin. And she recently ran her first marathon, and she's gotten Woo-hoo! Super into running and fitness. And don't worry, we're going to get her into ultra.
I know. We're very close. Oh, yeah. I could sense it. I could sense it. When Ruth and I were talking, I could sense that she was like getting bitten by the ultra bug.
Oh,
and
yeah,
she was,
for
she's
sure.
on the precipice. Ruth, I know you're listening. We're going to get you to do one.
You wait, Ruth. You just wait. So she was so organized as well, and also brought a lot of humor and fun, and she had fun outfits, and she had like joke cards, and Ruth and Nicole had never met each other before, so that was fun. The three of us ended up, you know, it was either Nicole, myself, and Rick, or Nicole, myself, and Ruth, so mm-hmm. we alternated lap by lap on that, and those laps end up taking a long time because through the night and you know, there's a lot of walking at that yep. point. So we had a lot of time together, and we just had some good laughs with both of them out there. And it, similar to the Pringles, there are things that looking back, I'm like, why did we think that was so funny? But just at the time, it's like the funniest thing that you could ever imagine. And
you're sleep deprived. Your brain is your brain is in a weird place. Your body's tired. Everything is, you know, not as it seems, so to speak. And so, yeah, everything yeah. becomes that much funnier. I'm sure, like, there's stuff that I said to Frank, maybe even during Tahoe. Like, yeah, some of the stuff I can actually remember. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is not going to translate in the quote-unquote real world. Like, when we go back and try and tell these stories again, people are going to give you blank stares and be like, okay, you're weird. But, you know, in the moment, it's just like, oh, yeah, remember that time when, you know.
And with all the love and respect in the world, Nicole seems to go particularly loopy in these races. So we had a lot of good laughs because at one point we started playing 20 questions. Mm-hmm. And as you're approaching the turnaround point at the Milford A station, there are these signs on the side for the planets, and they're spaced to represent how far the planets are from each other in the solar system. So, you know, you get to one, and as you get closer to the sun, they get closer, obviously, to represent the solar system. So that must have been on her mind or something. So we start playing 20 questions, and she's going first, and we finally get it down to, is it a planet? And then, yes. So Ruth and I start naming all the planets, and nope. And finally, I'm like, didn't we name all the planets? Nicole, is it Pluto? She's like, yes. Is that the one that's not actually a planet? Just like, this was the first question of 20 questions. And she's like, it's not really going great for me so far. So that became the joke. The Pringles and the Pluto, just we laughed and laughed for ages about those things just because we thought, oh, it was too funny at the time.
But those kinds of games, like, you know, like I shared on the Tahoe episode, like those types of brain games can be invaluable as you head out into the night laps, because it's very easy to get tunnel vision with your headlamp and just be sort of lulled into kind of like a sleepy state with just the darkness. And if it's cold and you're pretty, if you're pretty comfortable, so to speak, right? Like nothing, you're not in a lot of pain, you're not super hungry, you're not, you're tired, but you're not, you know, completely shutting down. You can sort of get lulled into even more of this dead sleep. And so having a pacer is really valuable. And B, having them have a job other than just running next to you, like telling you stories or asking you questions like Frank and I did, or playing 20 questions, those types of things. It's sort of, it's 2.0. It's next level pacing stuff that I think can be really valuable, because it's one thing to just recruit. It's hard enough sometimes to just recruit somebody to pace you, but giving them a secondary job, I think it actually makes their job a little bit easier, because you know, it's not really like, okay, now the emphasis is just on me running next to you. It's like, mm-hmm. we're going to hang out, we're going to have fun, we're going to play a game, we're going to chat, we're going to, you know, I'm going to tell you silly jokes or whatever it is. And it takes the pressure off and makes it more fun for both of you and gives them an actual job. And
And Rick and Ruth knocked it out of the park. So they, whether they're out there as competitors next year, mm-hmm. runners next year, or pacers, they will be on the list for sure, because they both did such an awesome job helping us get through it. And keeping, Ruth had to tell Nicole, like, I know you're really cold, but don't sit on the grate on top of the fire. Like, let's not do that. Or I know Nicole got super, super cold. That was a big problem for her in the night. So like, I know it would feel good to pour that chicken broth down your back, but let's hold on that decision to not do that. And then I have to thank Ruth particularly, because my ghost train almost ended quite early because I got stuck in the porta potty.
Oh no.
It was nighttime. I don't know what lap it was. We were coming back in and I was going to stop and I said, why don't you go ahead? I'll meet you at the tent, whatever. And she's like, I'm just going to wait here. And then 2 minutes later, Ruth, are you still there? I acknowledged there was probably some user error at that point, but there was something wrong with the door. I could not get out of the porta potty.
And she just brute force opened it?
I don't know what she did, but she got me out. And I'm grateful that I didn't have to end my first 100 miler by saying that I spent the rest of the night stuck in the porta potty, because that would have been not great.
So close and yet so far away, because those porta potties are like right there.
They are. Could hear everybody go by. Get me out of here.
People would just be like, am I hearing things? This is a hallucination.
I'm hallucinating. I didn't have any hallucinations. I was going to
be my
out.
Next question. Yeah, you were bummed out? Oh, I would say that's...
I don't know. I wanted the full experience. I did...
Next time.
That's right, next time. The only thing was, there was a section where it was more of a... almost like a jeep road. Mm-hmm. So there was grass in between, you know, grass along the sides and then grass in the middle. And it was quite long. So it was really that like soft type of grass. It has a little... I don't know, like very wavy and soft grass. And I don't know if you remember those, I don't even know what they're called. Those pictures, they were popular when I was younger, that you would, they look like just a mishmash of designs and you stare at them and then your eyes kind of cross and then like another picture pops out. Mm-hmm. The grass kept doing that to me and I couldn't look down while I was running because it kept doing whatever that's called.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that counts as a hallucination.
Shape-shifting.
That is what it certainly felt like, for sure. But other than that, no, things kind of stayed normal. Too bad.
So were there any particular like low spots? I mean, you know, there's been kind of the normal, like, I didn't really feel like eating. I got stuck in the porta potty, like, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, were there any low spots where you were like, that's it, I'm pulling the plug?
You know, I think, and I don't know that I did anything in particular, but I think I did a nice job of just focusing on the lap at hand and not getting stuck on, mm-hmm. you know, after that I have X number mm-hmm. of miles or X
that's
number
the kiss of
laps.
Of death.
I really didn't fall into that trap of like, oh wow, I'm almost done with 30 miles and then I have 70 more, because I think that's just an easy way to make the whole thing miserable. Mm-hmm. So mentally I was able to kind of, I felt good about that component of things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I would say the last 25 miles or so, mm-hmm. I was kind of physically hurting. I'm looking back at my notes here, pretty much fully walking I was fully walking by then. So it was hard, just physically it was hard, and I was tired, and there were sections where I felt low, like on the course. There were sections, you know, between spot A and spot B that I'm like, why is this 1 2-mile section 800 miles long? And I don't know why. I don't know what it was about those sections, but there were just certain things that felt like they took a really long time. Mm-hmm. So those were a little bit of a low, but nothing to the point where I felt like I just am going to pull the plug. I felt like at that point I was just so freaking determined to get to the finish line that I just, you know, heels in and just buckle down and keep moving.
Well, when you only have air quotes, only have a marathon left, you're like, yeah, no problem, yeah. Right?
It is kind of wild that it mentally you do kind of go there. Yeah. Yeah. I had one interesting moment where it was going out on at mile 75 where I was going out with just Rick, because Nicole at that point had gone ahead. She was moving a little faster than I was. So she had gone ahead, which was great. And so I was going out with just Rick, and we were just leaving camp, and he realized that I had forgotten my reusable cup, and they don't have cups at the aid station. So mm-hmm. he ran back to get it, and I just kept moving, and then he ran and caught up with me. So I had, I don't know, 10-15 minutes or so, 5-10-15 minutes of time totally by myself, mm-hmm. which I had not had at all pretty mm-hmm. much in the race. And it was right when things were getting light. Mm-hmm. So it was felt like a monumental moment. The light, you know, the sun is rising. And it was the first sort of moment I had had alone in a long, long time, many, many, many hours. So it gave me a few moments to sort of reset. Be like, why are you even out here? Why are you even doing this? And it was a good mental check in with myself to sort of recenter. And then he came up and he had my cup, and you know, I it's not like I wanted to go out on that lap by myself by any stretch of the imagination, yeah. but just those few minutes I found for me mentally helpful to just sort of recenter myself mm-hmm. and then you know, keep on moving.
Yeah. I find that if you don't have some time to yourself, it can be, and I also say this fully knowing that some people just do better having others around them all the time. But I have found personally that if I have some time by myself, I do much better because I can sort of minimize the noise, and not to say that I don't value the people that are around me and all that. It's just like, at some point my brain just needs a little bit of a break to do exactly what you're talking about. Just like take inventory. How are things both internally, like in between my ears, and externally with my physical body? You know, how's my stomach? How are all these things? And when you are kind of constantly surrounded by, you know, people or questions or activity, it can be, you can actually miss some key things that are maybe going on with you that you sort of brush off or are unattuned to because you're wrapped up in whatever else is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking at my notes here. One thing I wanted to mention was it was laps. I don't know. It was two of the laps where we had some walk run intervals that Rick guided us through. We had asked him to do that, and he did a stellar job guiding us through those walk run intervals. And then on the next lap, I think it was just Rick and I. So I think that was towards the end there where we were just walking. But we were moving along at a pretty good clip still. And when we got back, Rick looked at his Garmin. Those two laps were timed. They were within a minute of each other of the total time for those 15 miles each. And one of them included significantly more running than the other. And they were almost the exact same time. So it just showed me like, you know, all that the physical toll of doing those run intervals was enough that the walking was much slower. Mm. So then when we just did just the power walking, we ended up holding the same average pace. Okay, that's another point in the do more power walking column.
I remember when you sent me, you were so excited to send that to me. And I was like, oh my God, this is an amazing demonstration. Yeah, like this is sort of where you have to do the practice to kind of, you know, build the walking as a thing, even at all, even as an option, right? Because if you don't train it, it's not really an option. But it sort of shows that you can make some calculated decisions about your pacing and not have to expend as much physical energy, but still have a really solid pace and make up just the same amount of time and be within, you know, a minute's time between laps, and be, you know, less extended physically than had you just, you know, done the power walking.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's good tips for me for whatever comes next. Mm. Make sure that walking is part of it, and it'll benefit me in the end for sure.
Did you have a, we haven't quite gotten to the finish yet, but did you have a favorite part, like a favorite time of day, a favorite little section, a favorite little moment?
Oh gosh, it was so long.
I know.
There's a few that were great. Sunday morning, when the folks who were doing the 15 miler, they start at the other end and come to camp and then turn around and go back. And I had a friend who was doing that race. Mm-hmm. So like seeing them starting to come, and of course they all look like they're running a zillion miles an hour. They're so fast and fresh, and you know, the rest of us are look like swamp monsters, but
I know I want to love them, but I also secretly kind of hate them because, you know, they're like so happy and fresh and like, they're so fast and no, like, I mean, I love them obviously, but you're sort of like, oh crap, here come the 15 milers, and you have to like, you know, move over, and they're very nice. And they're always like, you know, congratulations, like keep going. Yeah. But I'm always like, oh man, here they come. It's just like another demonstration of how fast I'm not going.
Exactly. Excuse me. But I had a coworker and friend who is now also an ultramarathoner because she recently ran her 50K.
Woo-hoo.
So, she was in that 15 miler. So it was really fun to see her and get a big high five and all that. So that was really fun.
Awesome.
And then, I mean, for sure, coming into camp after that last lap, and as you go into camp, I have this awesome picture of my daughter was there to greet us as we came in, and she gave me a big hug. So I wasn't 100% sure if she and my mom, who was wonderfully helping the race by caring for our daughter and caring for our two dogs, I wasn't sure if they were going to make it up, and they did. So that was huge for me to you know that my daughter was able to see this thing that mom set out on, and all these hours that I've been away was all for this, so that she was there to see it, and she was totally into it. And next year she said she wants to be there the whole time.
Love it.
I don't know about that. We'll see about that. But so that was great to have my mom there and to have my daughter there. That was so meaningful, and just, you know, chug down that last section, go down to that bridge around that pumpkin and back, was pretty awesome. So I thought I was going to have a beautiful parallel, because I came in at 29 hours and 23 minutes or something like that. So I was toeing the line of that 30 hour mark. So I just took the whole time. I just wanted to enjoy myself for
the full experience,
30 hours. So they give a special award at Ultras, the DFL award, which is the dead fucking last award.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe I was going to get it. And I thought that was going to be a beautiful parallel, because I came in first in my first ultra. And I thought, oh, if I could come in DFL in my second ultra, that would be so cool. But a few other folks came in before the end, and it was amazing that the person who did earn the DFL was a woman who had to book it to come in. She came in with about, I think, 3 minutes to spare, which is the closest anyone has ever come. So it was so exciting to cheer for her. And she was coming along. She comes by our tent. We're cheering. She's like, I didn't know it was going to be a speed day. But it was awesome to be there for that, because a lot of folks have gone at that point.
Yes.
But to be able to cheer for her to come in, and, you know, the folks that were there to cheer for me, you know, almost DFL, but not quite. but
that would be an interesting, that would be an interesting, you know, juxtaposition, like first and last. But I think it would also just really demonstrate that this whole sport is very fluid. Like, just because you have one outcome, either first or last, doesn't necessarily mean that that's your fate going forwards, right? There's lots of ways. You've already identified a handful of things that you're going to address for the next time around. There's a ton of ways that you can influence the outcome every single time. And unless you continue to just do the same race year over year over year, the circumstances are going to change. You're going to change races. You're going to change altitudes. You're going to change time zones. You're going to change all these other things. And so it's sort of like, it's, I think it's really cool because you never get the same thing twice. I mean, even if you do the same race year over year, your circumstances change, right? You maybe have a different job, or you have children now, or, you know, there's different things. And so it's never happening in a vacuum. There's always going to be something.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that I will do this race again for sure. I feel like with what I learned this first time around, I want to iron out some of these things and then see what happens the next time. But it is a good reminder that, you know, next time, who knows? You just don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I can control the things I can control and prepare the way I know I need to prepare. But when you're out there, you just don't know quite what's going to happen. You just have to be ready for anything.
And that's sort of the fun of it too, I think, which I fully recognize can be the unnerving part for some people who very much like to be in control of all the elements and all the factors and have things sort of line up in a very specific, organized way. And so having lots of different variables and, you know, that can be unnerving. And I think I almost sort of push those types of people to do these races because I think it's a really good way to let go. And I say that as somebody who was that person, like, need to have things happen at a specific time. I still like order. I don't necessarily like chaos, but I do appreciate it in the context of an ultra because I have mentally turned it into a game for myself. Like, okay, here's the new challenge. Go. Like, it happens on the fly. Yeah. You know, you can reasonably forecast some of these things, and you can, you know, we talked about it in Run Your First 50K. You can reasonably forecast that X, Y, or Z is going to happen. We won't necessarily know when, we won't know to what degree, but it's likely that you'll experience this. So at least fast forward in your brain and sort of, you know, imagine yourself in that scenario. How would you handle it? How would you like to handle it? You know, and at least game plan it out so that on the spot, when it does present itself, you're not like, oh shit, never thought of this was going to like be a thing. I don't know. It's a funny, I just think it's interesting.
And I had tried to go down some of those tracks mentally for things that might have happened that never did. There were certain things that just
like
really
what?
Went fine. Like, my feet were fine. Mm-hmm. I had no blisters. They never, you know, they were sore. They were like sort of the pounding or like pressure a little bit.
And isn't that interesting coming from someone who struggled with such severe PF?
I know. And here I was with my feet totally, completely fine.
Yep. Love
it. And I changed my socks a few times, and I changed my shoes for, I think, the last 10 miles just because I wanted something like different structurally on my feet. But I had no blisters. I had no hot spots. That was totally fine.
Love it.
All right. I did get severe chafing on my lower back from my combination of my pack and my sports bra, which I had identified as a problem in the last interview, and got a new pack and everything seemed fine, but just over the number of hours, it was super duper not fine. It was pretty gross.
I wonder, because which pack did you end up wearing? The Salomon?
It's a Salomon. Yeah, the 12 liter, the unisex. I think it's the bra. I think it's the bra.
Okay, because I'm almost wondering, because now that I know that you didn't have a bladder in it, I'm almost wondering if, and I know the chafing was on the backside, right? I'm almost wondering if, because you didn't have equal weight front to back, that might have caused something.
Yeah, it could have been. I don't know though, because once it was clear that it was a big problem. And it was also clear that I was doing more walking. I switched into a different type of bra and it was fine after that. Mm. So it didn't, the like where the bra fell on my back was in a different spot with the second type of bra. And I never got chafing with that. And I was in that for a good amount of time. So I think it's just something about that bra doesn't, after whatever, 45 miles, it's time to, so I got to just try some more. You know, I thought I had a good combo and I didn't, it worked out okay because I was able to switch into a different type. But
And there's something to be said too, for just having a, if not a full change of clothes, at least a change of some clothes, because, you know, you're sweating, you're depending on where you are, you're accumulating dirt, or, you know, if it's raining, you know, like there is something to be said for getting out of those clothes, getting dry and or clean a little bit, and really sort of preserving your skin as best as you can to sort of reduce any sort of irritants that are going to get in there and do that. And yeah, for sure. Sometimes there are just things that pop up out of nowhere and that you can't control and you just have to sort of adapt on the fly.
Yeah. And the night running was something I had been a little bit not too excited about, and it ended up being okay. I had my headlamp and Nicole, everybody had their own headlamp, and we just kind of like tuck in and go. And there's lots of decorations along this course. So there's pumpkins all lit up, and there's all things that keep it interesting, that are fun and you know, how all Halloween themed. So that sort of takes a little bit of the edge off of the, you know, you don't feel entirely like you're super in the middle of the woods. You're within shot of houses and roads and things for a good amount of it. Not the whole time, but a good amount of it.
Did you meet the night running? Did you meet the beaver?
No, I don't know what that means.
So, you know, when you're, and it's not a joke, it's a real thing. So, you know, when you're running and you've got water on both sides of you, the low water that's like right at the level of the trail.
We called that Snake Alley because Nicole, I don't know if she actually was seeing snakes or she was hallucinating snakes.
No, there's snakes there. There's snakes there. There are definite snakes there. There's water snakes all along there that luckily, knock on wood, I have yet to actually see. I have heard them. I know that they're there. I have yet to see them, but no, there is a beaver that lives in that pond. It's like right before it's the pond that's right near the pumpkin bridge. I think. No, just kidding. but he lives in there, and especially at night when he's active, he slaps the water when you are too close or you disturb him. Yep. So a couple times, and it sounds like, I don't know if you've ever heard a beaver slap its tail, but like, it sounds like someone has dropped a boulder, like the size of a dog, into the water. And so maybe it was my first year, I was running by myself and I was like, holy shit, what is that? And then it happened again on my next lap. And then I don't know if I overheard somebody say it or then I realized what it was, but the first time was further away. The next time he was like right here next to the trail. And I was like, ah.
I bet your heart rate just spiked right up.
Skyrockets. Yeah. But yeah, he's a thing. Like you'll hear people talk about him sometimes. I've heard him many, many times. So it's always interesting to me. I'm always like, where's the beaver? Is he out? Is he out? Is he out?
There is a sign that you go by that's like a yellow warning sign that said, that's just an image, like, you know, like a yield, you know, crosswalk sign or whatever, and it's a person getting chased by an owl. And I was like, who put up that silly sign? It's not a silly sign. No. There is actually an owl there that attacks people. Mm-hmm. So there's this one section that we did see some owls swooping down over the trail. Luckily we never got attacked, but I think it was last year somebody got attacked by the owl and they were like bleeding all over their head. So luckily no wildlife encounters to report, but that was not a silly Halloween sign. It was actually a real sign because there is an owl that attacks people.
And that's a new thing too. That owl is a new thing that wasn't, I didn't experience it last year, but I did hear people talking about it. So yeah, you know, all sorts of things. We did actually one day I was out there training before the race and saw coyotes out there sort of in the section where it's after Well, if you're going outbound away from camp, it's after you pass by, you know, where the beaver is, when the side walls come up a little bit and you're sort of down in the, so there were coyotes walking like along the trail, like sort of through the, cause that, I think that intersects the rest of the walking trails and sort of, they turn into snowmobile trails in the, in the winter. And I think they probably sort of have free rein out there. Yeah. So I was like, is that a, oh no, that's definitely a coyote. Okay. Just checking.
I'm guessing during the actual race, there's a lot of, so many people back and forth that limits, you know, those animals aren't going to come.
Yeah. I never saw anything. I didn't even see skunks or raccoons or anything like that. I mean, I heard the beaver and heard the snakes. Yeah, that was really it. So
I was trying to think of any other good stories to share, but it just was such a good experience. I'm so glad I didn't send that email and you know, pull out of the race. And I know that there are so many things I can improve on and do better. And, you know, I learned so much. And even if I had only done, you know, one lap or something, I think it would have been worth going through the motions of the gear and all of this stuff. And so I think if you're in a similar situation where you're not totally sure, you never know what's going to happen. And I kind of, there was somebody in the Run Your First 50K group who posted a similar question where they had a questionable physical thing. And I had shared my story that, like, I don't know, are there other benefits you can get from it, even if you're not doing whatever performance that you thought might happen? And I'll have to follow up with that person, see how it went for them.
Yeah, I think it was Jesse. I think it was Jesse, and I think she finished. She ran the full 50.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So your plan is to do Ghost Train again. Yep. Do you have any other races that you're sort of eyeing as lead ups to that?
I don't have anything on the schedule. Based on what I have learned, I know it has to be earlier than Notch View was. Though Notch View was really fun, so it's going to be hard not to do that again. But if I did it again, I would need to maybe just do like the 6 hour or something. If I want Ghost Train to be my focus, I think I need to go through the summer a little differently than I did this past year. But one thing I'm thinking about doing is not an official race or anything, but just on my own, or Nicole already said she wanted to do it, is to run a Pemmy loop, a Pemmy through the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Yep. Is this one particular loop that's a 50K. You do about 8 summits in the White Mountains, and those trails are really, really no joke. They're very, very steep, very, very rocky. And I have hiked in the White Mountains a fair amount, and every time I see people doing a Pemmy loop, I'm like, wow, they look absolutely miserable. And now I'm like, oh, I think I'm going to do that. So I have a number of, and I think part of the reason I am leaning towards doing this is that elevation change scares me. So I figure, why not do something that involves 4,000 footers?
Yep.
And I like the idea, you know, there's so many places around me, because I live in a suburban area, that you can find these little trails, but you're basically within sight of a house all the time. You know, you're not in the woods.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of really making sure I can lock in my safety gear and my first aid gear and my communication gear and all that stuff. So that, because if when you're in the White Mountains, you can't just go, you know, you got to be really prepared because you're way out there and you're not going to have a cell signal and all of this. So I'm thinking about doing a Pemmy loop, maybe late spring. You know, I know that I have to let all the snow melt, which can take a long time.
Yes.
But so that's kind of one thing I'm thinking, and then Ghost Train. But other than that, I don't have anything. I'm doing the off-season training right now, the off-season RX. Woo-hoo. And it's definitely, so at this point it is a month today since Ghost Train. And I still think I'm recovering. I have had a lot of fatigue recently. I think, you know, I don't know. I think I got a lot of other stuff going on, but I, based on the follow-up from Notch View, feeling unsettled into Ghost Train, and then now after Ghost Train, feeling a lot of this fatigue, I think that I'm learning that I need a lot of recovery. And I think that what I'm doing right now isn't maybe quite working quite right. I think I need to tweak a few dials or something, because I, so regularly leading up to both Notch View and Ghost Train, you know, the alarm goes off at 4:15, 4:30, get up, do do something, do a ride, do a run, do a strength workout. Shakedown first, of course, and then go to work. I have to be to work on the early side. So, but that was like sort of normal operating procedure. Now it's like, it's a real struggle to get anything done in the morning. Yeah. So I think that there's just some more recovery that I need to do and let myself go through that. And if that means that the way things time out means that there's no summer big race because I need to recover so much, then that's fine. That's what it is. Or if I want the summer race to be my focus and ghost train is just an add-on, then I can do that. Mm-hmm. But having two that close together is not going to be the plan because that didn't go great for me.
And I think that's a really smart way to go about it, just to sort of really take the time to assess how you're feeling and not just assume that a given quote unquote rest interval post 100 miler is appropriate for you across the board. I think that I was very much the same in that once I finished that race, my body was just like, it was sort of like a collective, phew, okay, everything's done now and we can sort of power down. And so I felt sort of the same way, like lots of sleep, not a lot of activity. You know, I felt okay physically. I didn't really have a lot of issues, but it was just like, I don't really have any energy for anything except sitting around and, you know, maybe I'll do a shakedown. I don't really feel like doing anything else. And so I bring that up because I think some people assume that they should just get right back into it. And it's like, I mean, you might be able to, but are you then digging yourself an even bigger hole that won't set you up for success in the next cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. So it'll be a, you know, in a year's time when I have more, you know, if I have a actual full recovery from a 100 miler under my belt, I can look back and say, you did need that 6 weeks or you did need whatever amount of time. And, you know, I also recently went back and listened to the episode you did on sleep because I am so fatigued in my bones, yet I can't seem to sleep very well. So I'm trying to put in some things to improve the sleep because that has been an area of struggle. Cause it's like, well, I'm so exhausted and you'd think that you could just sleep, but that doesn't always seem to be the way it works out.
Yeah. I have, Risa and I have been trading some emails and I want to have her back on again to talk about napping because, I suck at napping. And so it's one of the things that I really want to get better at. And I'm super jealous of Frank, who can just literally power down anywhere at a moment's notice.
And my sister can do that.
It's
cool.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, I just, it's not a skill that I have yet. And so we don't have a date picked for it yet, but I really want to have her come on because what she shared in the previous sleep podcast was really helpful for a lot of people, including myself. And this napping component, especially for runners and ultra runners and just like busy people in general, can be really helpful, especially if you're someone like Frank or your sister who can power down pretty quickly. But the rest of us who sort of struggle with this, you know, and if you're doing a 100-mile race or if you're doing a PemiLoop or if you're, you know, doing a stage race or whatever, you know, the ability to sort of take a cat nap or a quick Frank and I actually joked about taking like a Courtney DeWalter, like 1 minute nap during Tahoe, because I'd be like, I just need to close my eyes for 1 minute. And it would be very short period of time, but I wouldn't actually fall asleep. But ironically, it was very restful, even though I didn't actually sleep, just letting the body sort of go dormant for a minute was just really helpful. So anyway, that's going to come up soon. So I'll be interested.
I'll have to try that because I did sit down at the aid stations a few times to eat or like change shoes and stuff like that. But I never laid down and I never sat for more than a few minutes. It was probably longer than I realized, but it didn't feel like it wasn't like a, ooh, I need to sit down for a while. Yeah. It was like, I need to change my shoes. So I'm going to sit down. And maybe it would have been beneficial to really get the feet up for, you know, a minute or two to, you know, I didn't really try that. And I probably should have.
Yeah. I experimented with it a little bit at Ghost Train and then also at Tahoe too. And it's, you know, again, I sort of just took the approach like every little bit helps, right? Like just do it for a couple seconds and who knows, maybe it'll, you do have to sort of toe the line between how long do you sit down and will it then be more difficult for you to get up? You're going to need somebody to like hoist you up.
You see all these signs, you know, beware the chair. Like once you sit down, you're not going to want to get up. So I think I was a little scared to even sit down at all. And I get that, but maybe I was more scared of it than I should have been. Maybe I should have seen the value of getting off the feet for a few minutes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming back on and sharing because I think everyone was so invested. I got a lot of positive feedback from your previous episodes. Like everyone was very invested in what you were up to. So I'm excited to share this with them. And you know, just sort of show people the progression, right? Like, you know, show that even though you've never done an ultra before, you can not only do your first, you can also do your farthest. And it's an iterative process, right? Like it's constantly tweaking and evolving and practicing, and you know, just the fact that you have so much fun with it, I think is also a really great show, because this is what it's supposed to be all about, right? It's not supposed to be like, I mean, and like if you're a super competitive person and you really like that aspect of it, great. But I think there's lots of women out there that could benefit from doing an ultra, but they're sort of reserved about it because they perceive it to be an uber competitive sport, when in reality, it's mostly like people like us out there having fun.
Yes. Yes. There was a woman out there celebrating her 70th birthday.
I saw her
running. I think she did 30 miles, which she had like the sash on, yes, and the crown. It was like, I just want to be her when I...
She and all her girlfriends. She had like a whole pack.
All her girlfriends. She had a whole crew.
It was amazing. Awesome. We saw them at the Milford Aid Station when she came through, and then I got to see her. I think they were mostly just walking, like mostly power walking, because I saw them at the other end, and then there was a long elapse of time, and then I saw them at camp when I was there with you and Frank, and she came through, and it was just so cool. Yeah, she's 70.
That was pretty...
It was amazing.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's ultra running goals right there.
I know, for sure. Have you done an interview with Frank about Ghost Train?
I have
Are
not.
You planning on it?
Nope.
Okay.
I have not.
I'm very excited. I feel like Rick got to hang out with Frank and his wife more than I did. I saw him very briefly, but he did come back to get his stuff. And so I was able to chat with him a little bit, but I'm interested to hear his take on Ghost Train 2022.
He learned a lot of lessons. And I don't want to give any spoilers, but he learned a lot of lessons, a lot of important things. And he went into it trying to stack the deck, I think. Like he was really, because again, he's in for Tahoe. So he was practicing a lot of things and really sort of hitting that upper limit, right?
Yep.
So I'm just trying to think of what to, you know, how to sort of describe it. Like, I guess really just stacking the deck is like the best way to think about it, because he was trying to sort of simulate Tahoe in a way and really test what his upper limit capabilities were. And so I think he learned a lot of lessons, and he'll be able to, he sent me a message not long after that race that I don't want to say it because it's so good and I want him to be able to share it.
Let's save it.
Yeah. It's very sort of, it's very indicative of the highs and the lows that go into training for and racing and really rubbing up against your upper limits. And he and I sort of geek out over this concept just of your upper limits a lot. Because that is what ultras are all about, like finding your limit and then seeing if you can go further, you know, rubbing up against that upper limit and saying, okay, is that it? Or do I have more? And how do I test if I have more? And is that it? Do I have more? Like, you know, it's just, we just continue to keep going.
I keep wondering what the next test is upper limit for an individual who has recently run 200 miles. So I keep waiting for that to learn what's next for you.
I'm curious. It's a hard question, and it's one that I have spent so many hours asking myself. I honestly don't know. Because where do you go from here? Right? And to what end and for what purpose? And those are really the questions that I'm like.
Do the other distances still catch you? Are you still interested in doing 50, 100? Are those?
I don't particularly care for 50 because it's just hard enough that to be like, it's sort of that in between where it's just like just hard enough that it's kind of like, I don't know. Like I, you know, and that's not to say that I am not interested in doing another 50K or like a different 100 miler. I didn't love the 50 mile distance. So I don't know. I think I really just have to sort of look at what's out there. And then there's always like, okay, well, do we go further? Frank and I have talked about like, he really wanted to do Cocodona 250. Mm-hmm. And he was like, maybe I should just do 200 miles first. I was like, that's probably a good idea. And so, you know, the challenge about that one is, again, another 50 miles, but also the environment, which is Arizona.
Yeah.
Which is, it won't particularly be very hot because of the time of year, but it'll still be warm and I don't particularly do well in the heat. Mm-hmm. The sand is probably really going to get me, but you're also going through a bunch of different climates and zones and terrains. Yeah. So, I mean, that is of interest to me. Not, and I guess there is just this, it's kind of cliche, but, there is something very interesting that happens in the second 100 where, especially if you've only done 100 before, to quote Frank, like, this is as far as I've run. No, this is as far as I've run. Like every, you know, every step that you take is now officially the farthest that you have gone. And there is something special about that. But I do think that there is also something really special about the second 100. And it becomes less about, for me, it became less about a race and more about this whole, like internal experience, because I will still be out on like a trail run or a walk right now and have these sort of flashbacks in a good way of just this very euphoric feeling of being out on the second 100 and being like, this is the most fucking amazing thing ever. And I've already run 100 and I don't know how many miles. And I'm just like, this is the most amazing thing ever. And I'm reticent to do it again because obviously like, what if it's not the same? What if it sucks? But also, do I want to be chasing that high indefinitely? Like, you know what I mean? So, I don't know. Just, this is random.
These are some like meta level questions here.
Yeah.
But you said to me at the beginning about, you know, I had a great outcome with Notchview. And if I had called it then, I had this thing and then it was good. And now I'm not going to do it again because I don't want to have a bad experience. Yeah. So apply that to your 200.
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, again, it's like, also the number of 200s, the number of available races to pull from, the pool is much smaller. You know, then there's like Bigfoot, very difficult, like very, very challenging. Also much more remote, more possibility of mountain lions, just saying.
or Bigfoots too.
Or Bigfoots. I mean, that's a possibility. And that's not to say that, you know, I wouldn't encounter other wildlife like doing Cocodona. I mean, if I had to lean towards anything, I would say it would be Cocodona, but I wouldn't be able to do it until 2024. So we're already like another year away. So more time to, you know, marinate on whatever the thing is going to be. But that's sort of like, that's kind of where my brain is at. It's just like, you know, where do you go from here? To what end? What, for what purpose? I mean, I've already at this point far beyond exceeded what I initially thought. Like if you had asked, you know, 2006 version of Megan, would you run a 200-mile race? I'd tell you you were fucking insane. But turns out I'm the insane
one,
right?
That was my year of my first marathon. So look back.
Yeah.
Times change.
Yeah. So I also can see it from that perspective. Like, okay, well, I also told myself back then I wouldn't do this. And then I did this. So then what's the thing, you know? But then it becomes a situation of, you know, like Candace Burt, the race director for the Tahoe for Destination Trail. She's currently trying for the world record of consecutive 50Ks. I think she's on day, I want to say she's on day 7 at least. I don't know. I could check maybe in real time here, but, you know, then, so then what happens, you know, then what happens? I can't do it because my phone wants to do an update right now, but, right. Like, what's the end? And I'm not saying that there needs to be an end, but I don't want to get sucked. I don't want to keep going because I feel compelled for some other reason to keep going when there's no need to. I don't know that I'm accurately conveying what I think, but.
Well, I'll be very interested to see where all of your meta thoughts take you and what the thing is that catches you for the next goal. Big, scary goal.
Me too.
You'll share it on the podcast when you know what
too.
It is.
Me too.
Yeah.
Of course I will. Of course I will. Okay, well, I hope that you guys enjoyed that conversation with Sarah. Was I right about all the pearls of wisdom that she had to share? I hope you guys picked up maybe a few tips and tricks as well, things that you could potentially try on or during your next race. And I just want to say, you guys, thank you to everyone that has been listening to the podcast over the last couple of years. Thank you to everyone that has followed me on Instagram and who have joined the Run Your First 50K community. It has been a real pleasure for me to get to work with and create content for you guys, and as well as to share my journey in running. And no, this isn't me signing off, like saying goodbye. This is just a big dose of gratitude. And just, you know, I wanted to say thank you and let you know that I have more planned. I'm not quite ready to tell you what it is yet, but big things for 2023. And I hope that you guys are also planning some big epic shit for 2023, right? I had this real, and I know it kind of happens a lot over the holidays, but I had this real epiphany. I think it was actually on Christmas Day, and I don't remember what I read, and I'm going to try not to get emotional about it because I got very emotional about it the day that I read it. But it was basically something about how short life is. And I've read this sort of stuff a ton before, but for some reason, this one thing really struck me and it brought me to tears, and it really made me aware of really just how short we are here. And so if you are contemplating doing your first ultra or your farthest ultra, and you're thinking about maybe putting it off or not doing it at all for whatever reason, I just want to throw out there that you've got time, but not much. Okay. So like, don't keep putting these things off. What's the worst that could happen? You train for it. And like Sarah and I talked about in the episode, like you have to stop or you can't make it on race day or whatever. You won't regret having gone through the process of training and practicing and testing your upper limits, right? I really truly believe that if more people, more women specifically, did ultras, you would see how it increases your overall quality of life. And so obviously that's my mission. I'm on a mission to get as many women as I can, 10,000 specifically, but as many women as I can to complete this task. And if you're thinking you can't do it, I've just given you a myriad of podcast episodes that you can go back to and listen to, interviews, informational episodes that will demonstrate the complete opposite to you. All you have to do is try. All you have to do is set the goal, make the intention, and show up every day and execute on it. Don't think about the super long term. Think about the short term. Just show up and give it your best effort every single day. All right, you guys, that's all for this episode. Enjoy this beat, and I'll see you all soon.